Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. Yes, it's your favorite professor here, and I'm here with my favorite professor, Perry Blatz. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing just fine today.
That's great to hear. Great to hear. You're happy to be here in the bunker?
Well, it was, it's always the security provisions are so strong here, thank heavens.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, of course, we all have to worry about security. Getting into the bunker, all of the security provisions going through them and the careful vetting and so on, the aggressive vetting that goes on are worth it, I think, to appear here and have a chance to spend some time with you.
Oh, I know. And it's climate controlled, of course. And that's a good thing because we're going to talk about one of some people call the most hot-headed president we've ever had, Andrew Jackson, the 7th president of the United States. And he's very relevant to today's time, shall we say, because he's considered or was considered at the time, and certainly it's considered by historians afterward, as perhaps one of the most personal presidents we've ever had, or even maybe the first personal president we've ever had, or one that relied so much on personality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly. Certainly. I think we can have we can identify a trend from the time of George Washington all the way up to the upcoming inauguration of presidents that are first in the early years of the Republic, rather distant and often eager to be distant from the people. Right. With Jackson, we see someone who enjoyed popular acclaim. There are all kinds of stories, even when he was leaving the presidency, when he would stop in a town, people would gather. Even though his health was often poor, he would stand up and shake hands with everyone who was around him. I mean, he had great popular appeal, really our first president to have that kind of direct popular appeal, that sense of a relationship with the public that could vote at that time, which of course would be just adult males.
That's right, yeah.
But he had that sense of a personal relationship. He took great pride in it, almost seeing himself as a kind of father figure to the American people. And just to continue the trend, I think from that time on, the American public has expected more of a personal relationship with its leaders, and that relationship may be positive, it may be negative, but there's more and more information that people like to have, certainly between Twitter and Facebook and all kinds of bits of information, and there is this sense of a need of a personal relationship and identification with the president that certainly wasn't anticipated in the earliest days of the United States. And we can begin to see its development in Andrew Jackson. And I think he was often appreciated for the hotness and directness of his temper.
Right.
I mean, we've heard a lot in recent weeks about presidential temperament. Well, Jackson had a kind of temperament that resonated with the common people. And it resonated negatively to some. It resonated most positively to many others, but there was that sense of, you know, that you knew the president. You knew what he might do. He's going to get mad about this. He's going to protect us in this situation. And, of course, for the time, this was a time of paternalism in all sorts of forms,
right.
A sense of government or other institutions acting as the father in a family was at least traditionally expected to do. And that was Jackson's sense of taking care of the American Republic, taking care of the American people. And that sense of a personal relationship was very much there, and I think it continues to this day.
So is Jackson sort of the first president where we get that strong personality connection with the people? And then we have Honest Abe halfway through the century, then Teddy Roosevelt at the end of the century, and on and on and on and on and on.
Oh, certainly. I think that's a very accurate observation. Jackson, of course, had nicknames like the Old Hero from his success at the Battle of New Orleans, that we'll talk about. Old Hickory, this sense of what's the sort of the hardest thing available in an age before much use of steel and iron, and it was hickory. And people identified with that. And, of course, we can only see it getting stronger and stronger with, of course, the much beloved figures you've mentioned, but also even in negative ways. Jackson necessarily excited a lot of negative comment. And, of course, whatever our presidential candidates and successful candidates, they'll have their supporters and detractors, and often in a very bitter, visceral, and personal kind of fashion.
That's right. Yeah.
And we can see that with Jackson. You really can't see it with the previous figures in the presidency. George Washington, of course, generated a great deal of awe and respect, and that was not quite the same. It was a more distant relationship. Mm-hmm. Jackson gets inside of that distance. Certainly, he wanted respect. He craved respect, but he also craved affection in a way that I don't think George Washington really did. I don't think he would have thought it was appropriate.
Mm. And we were certainly seeing that now here in 2016-17, where we have had a highly personal election and having a mm-hmm. highly personal inauguration coming up. But let's go back and talk about his origins, because they're certainly humble.
Oh, and this set him apart from previous occupants of the White House.
We should remind the buzzkillers that Jackson is number 7, comes in office in 18.
He is elected in 1828 and begins office in 1829, right. Serves 2 terms ending in 1837.
And the founding father generation is starting to die off.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I mean, Jackson, of course, was involved in the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. He was a young man. He was in his, he was almost 13 when the British went south to, in the hope of having more success in the southern states than they had had after Lexington conquered. Mm-hmm. Washington crossing the Delaware, et cetera. So 1779, 1780, the British go south. Jackson was born in 1767, right along the North South Carolina border. Mm-hmm. His father owned land. I wouldn't say he was a wealthy man. He had immigrated just a little bit before, and Andrew Jackson hardly ever knew his father. His father died shortly after his birth. His mother had the difficult job of raising Andrew and his brothers. When the British came south, they adopted a kind of scorched earth policy to try to rally loyalists and to discourage American patriots. Jackson's town was captured by the British.
This town in North Carolina, South Carolina.
Yes, still it's called the Waxhaws. Okay. And I don't believe, at least from what I've read, I don't think it's clear whether the spot, we may not exactly know the spot where Andrew Jackson was buried, but—
Born, you mean.
If we knew that spot, yes, born, not buried, sorry. We do know the spot where he's buried in Tennessee, but I don't think we know really whether he was born in North Carolina or South Carolina, or at least I don't know that.
Right. I know that it's unclear because I don't think the borders were at
work. Borderland. The border may not have been very well marked and
it didn't matter. Really.
Whatever house it was may have moved and so on.
Yeah.
But it was very much a kind of frontier log cabin sort of society. And pioneer sort of society. And of course, none of our previous presidents were from such humble upbringing. Terribly wealthy at the beginning of their lives, but they were from very well-settled families in a much more settled part of the country.
Right.
But
Virginia
and
Massachusetts.
Sure. The Adamses and, of course, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Washington, the Virginians. So Jackson, in the Revolution, at one point, the story is that, and I've not seen it denied anywhere. It's a very good story, but yes, I think it's an accurate story. A British officer who's sort of occupying the settlement where he lived came up to him and said, shine my boots, boys, or something like that. That's not an exact quote. And the 12 to 13-year-old Andrew Jackson refused. And he got slashed by a saber in the face, and he had that scar for the rest of his life. One of his brothers died in the fighting. Another brother who was captured died later. Andrew was captured, and his mother had to go down to Charleston sort of to find a way to get him out of British custody. His mother died soon after that. So at the age of 13, he was without parents.
Yeah.
Without siblings, and had to find a way to make his way in the world.
But also he's now got this, which presumably is used later, this great story of being forged in the heat of the Revolution as a very young, developing mind and developing personality. and can, and of course, bears the scar, as you say.
Oh, sure, sure, sure. Physically bears the scar. And there is psychological analysis. And, of course, there are some historians who love psychological analysis. And, of course, we think of Professor Freud and all of this. There are some who have sort of, you know, the sense that the nation becomes a, you know, this, his great patriotic devotion to the new nation ends up substituting for the mother and father he had lost.
Oh, right.
It's an interesting way to think about it, at the very least. But he did spend a few years in his teens in various carousing type activities.
Right.
He enjoyed a good time in the Carolinas, but he turned to the practice of law. Jackson was not as much of an educated man as his predecessors in the presidency, but for the frontier, he picked up enough education. And he read law, which is how you became a lawyer at that time.
Yeah, you didn't necessarily go to law school in those days.
There were not law schools per se. Yeah. You could take some law courses at universities if you got there in colleges, but Jackson didn't do that. He read with local practitioners. And by the time he's 20, 21, he is working with other lawyers. And he is also moving west into what will become Tennessee.
Okay.
Tennessee doesn't enter the Union until 1796. Before then, it's, you know, it begins to be organized as a territory. But very early in that, in the early 1790s, he is out by what becomes Nashville, and he is serving as a public prosecutor,
right,
and dealing with all kinds of different cases in that, and of course making a little money, buying a little land, speculating in land, as was so common on the frontier, making some good deals, acquiring slaves, of course, which was common, especially throughout the South at that time. And it's at that time one of the great controversial and personal episodes of his career occurs, and that's his marriage to his beloved wife, Rachel right. Donelson, the daughter of really one of Nashville's founding families. Of course, Andrew didn't get there much after it had been founded. Andrew was very close to these founding families. But Rachel Donelson had married a man named Lewis Robards in the 1780s when she was very young, about 1785, I think, was the date of the marriage.
Uh-huh.
They didn't get along. At one point, Robard sends the young Rachel back to Tennessee to her family.
That's almost if you take her back because I don't want her.
Well, I think that again, the sense of the husband's responsibility. You know, the idea was that in the thinking of that time, someone had to be responsible
for the
wife. You know, either the family was or the husband was, but you weren't sort of out there as a single woman. And Jackson, who I believe is a border of some sort or has a place on the Donelson's property, meets Rachel, thinks she's wonderful. There's a good deal of controversy on exactly what happens next, but it seems that, well, certainly by 1790, Robards asks for a divorce, which is a very complex process in early America.
Oh, sure.
Rachel and Andrew, and of course we don't have film of what they did. There were no security cameras at the time.
But no WikiLeaks.
No. Lots of leaks, but no WikiLeaks. But they went down to Natchez, of course, further west.
Oh, becomes Mississippi,
yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's an old Spanish settlement and been there for a long time. And
they go down as an unmarried couple?
Well, it's not.
Oh, that's unclear.
It's not exactly clear. But there does seem the bulk of the evidence that I have read seems to show that they lived together as man and wife for a while. They did get married. Exactly what happened when, again, is not entirely clear. But what is clear is that while Robards had filed for divorce, it wasn't an easy process.
Yeah.
And it was not granted until 1794, by which point the Jacksons decide to get married again.
Okay.
To sort of confirm the fact that they are not bigamists. And Andrew Jackson, like many men on the frontier, got involved in a number of fights and duels.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to get into a duel with Andrew Jackson, some people took this route, you would say something negative about his beloved Rachel, and that they may have been living in adultery, living in sin at mm-hmm. some point as this divorce goes through. And that becomes an especially major charge when Jackson becomes a presidential candidate many years later in 1824. Yeah. But armed with Rachel and with this issue finally settled in the 1790s, he becomes more prominent attorney, becomes wealthier. He serves briefly as as one of Tennessee's first congressmen.
Okay, so I was going to ask, is he still there, still in Tennessee? Yeah, okay.
Oh, sure, sure. His whole career is in Tennessee, other than a couple brief sojourns in Washington as a representative, a senator. But he doesn't even serve his full term.
Why not? Does he just not want to, or are we getting close to the War of 1812?
No. This is back. This is 97, 98.
Okay.
He actually participates. He refuses to endorse a resolution that essentially thanks George Washington for all the wonderful things he's done for the country. At the end of Washington's second term, there was a good deal of disagreement with Washington's stance on a treaty with Britain, the Jay Treaty.
Oh, yeah.
And Jackson, in one of the few things he was really involved in Congress, refused to vote for a resolution endorsing Washington as president at the end of his term, a kind of sort of farewell resolution,
wow.
because he was so bitterly against the Jay Treaty with Britain. Of course, Jackson's no great friend of Britain, having sure. been slashed by a British officer.
When he was 13. Yeah.
At this point, about 17 years before. I think it's right at the very end of Washington's second administration. But he doesn't have much of a presence in Congress.
That must have taken – I mean, I can't imagine that sort of – of course, we have to rethink about what we can and cannot imagine happening politically nowadays. But I can't imagine, you know, the founding father, you'd have an awful lot of backbone to say, I don't support this farewell resolution, which is just a giveaway.
Yes.
No one's going to be upset that you voted for it, but he really wanted to stand up.
But that gives us an inkling of the kind of backbone that Andrew Jackson showed throughout his political and military career.
Right.
The kind of thing that, his word got around, that he had this kind of solid standing, he begins to build a reputation. But of course, that's most clearly built in the War of 1812, where of course he becomes really the transcendent military figure in the country.
Okay, does he be when he leaves the Senate and presumably goes back to Nashville? Or
he becomes a judge for a while. After a while, he quits that and sort of focuses actually on paying off some debts. While he was a wealthy man,
his
wealthy man in that era often had a good deal of debt.
He
gets shot in a duel in 1806.
Okay,
so he has a very though he manages to kill his opponent in that duel, he is wounded in the chest.
Yeah,
and the story of that duel, actually, that person, a man named Dickinson, who Jackson killed in a duel, he had made the mistake of saying something negative about Rachel, Jackson's beloved wife. And they, after extensive negotiations, they get involved in a duel. Dickinson fires first, and the story is told that everyone could see a puff of dust from Jackson's coat.
Yeah.
So it clearly hit him, but Jackson didn't fall. And Jackson hadn't fired yet, and he carefully cocks his gun, and he does take care of Dickinson. And it's revealed that he has a wound in the chest, but it hit no vital organs, and I believe that bullet was there to Jackson's death.
Right.
So Jackson's very prominent in Nashville, and Tennessee, of course, had become a state of the Union by this point. In the 1790s into the 1800s, it's becoming a rapidly growing state. Jackson seeks to become more prominent in its state militia.
Uh-huh.
And
so that's how he starts the military career.
Exactly. And by the War of 1812, and just to review for our listeners, the War of 1812 was with Great Britain,
uh-huh.
and Jackson certainly was happy to sign on to that. But along the frontier, the concern was that Britain and also Spain were influencing Native Americans against the settlers.
Oh, because I don't think it. I certainly don't think of that aspect of the War of 1812. But that must have been the big thing in Florida, Louisiana area.
That was the main concern.
Wow.
The British were taking people whom they said had been British sailors off American ships in the Atlantic and other places, and that was more likely to bother people along the coast who might have had relatives who were sailors and so on. But the concern on the frontier was British aid, and especially in Jackson's area, Spain, which by that time was an ally of the British in the Napoleonic Wars that are sort of going on simultaneously.
That's why some historians talk about the War of 1812 as being part of the First World War. You know,
Sure. And of course, at that time, too, the U.S. border, the United States included Louisiana through the Louisiana Purchase a few years before by President Jefferson, but it did not include Florida. And there was actually, they referred to the Floridas, West and East Florida. So the Florida panhandle went a little further west than it does now. But that southeast coast, there was lots of concern over what might be going on in Florida, and also what was going on with the Native American tribes that pretty effectively occupied portions of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, even though that was all U.S. territory.
Right.
They had not been essentially forced out of those lands, and that was a major point on Andrew Jackson's agenda.
In the 1820s.
Going right on up the 20s and the 30s, the expulsion, essentially, of Native Americans beyond the Mississippi River. But Jackson becomes a general in the Tennessee militia. At one point, he helps establish his reputation early in the war because he is sent with a large number of volunteers down to New Orleans. And when he gets there, he's told to that a lot of his men aren't needed and that he should turn over his command. Well, Jackson didn't like that very much, but they had the difficult task of getting back up the river. And it was very difficult. This is the very early days. I think it's before there was any real steamboat service back up the river to Tennessee. And so Jackson sort of has to, tap his own finances and lead his men and take care of the many sick men that you always had in any military setup at that time, and to get them back to Tennessee. And he does, and gets the devout affection of many of the men who served with him, because the idea was that he took care of them. And he made sure they got back. And so all that is before any military success in the War of 1812.
Even before the Battle of New Orleans?
Oh, sure. Oh, I mean, he is beloved by his Tennessee troops.
Oh, okay.
Because he helps them get back home before they're ever involved in battle, the very beginning of the war. In 1813 and 1814, he takes the field again with his Tennessee troops to attack Native American groups. These are a faction of, I think, I'm not very strong in the details of the particular tribes, but I know there are the Chickasaw and the Creeks. There was a faction of those tribes known as the Red Sticks, from which we get the capital of Louisiana, Baton Rouge. I don't recall exactly how they got the name of this faction. Maybe it had something to do with their readiness to go to war. The tribes were split, and Jackson fought with some Native American allies, fought these other southeastern Indians, and defeated them several times. He then went. Captured the city of Pensacola in Florida as Spain's hold on Florida is beginning to weaken. And that leads him across to New Orleans at the end of 1814 into the beginning of 1815, when, as of course a recent Professor Buzzkill program pointed out
to
us, the war was ending with negotiations, but people were not aware of the end of that war. And so, while it was after the Treaty of Peace was signed, of course, the Treaty of Peace was not in effect. On January 8th, 1815, at the Battle of New Orleans, Jackson led his troops against the Bloody British, as the old song went, and defeated them massively, defeated a larger British force of all kinds of veterans and so on. They lined up behind cotton bales, and they defended their position, and it was a great victory. And while, of course, the peace hadn't gone into effect, even beyond that, what was important was that this was really the last battle of substance in the war.
Okay.
And news of it gets to the population centers on the East Coast of the United States just before the treaty arrives. So, especially without access to social media and the internet and so on, people get a sense is that Jackson won They hear that first, and the war is over.
Oh, so it's almost as if Jackson won the war.
I really think that's what a great many Americans believed. Again, we were, we didn't have flash polls and that kind of thing, but it really is this sense.
New Orleans, yeah.
Yes.
At real Andrew Jackson.
And that's what really builds his reputation. I mean, his earlier successes against the Baton Rouge essentially open up most of the southwestern United States to settlement. But his success in beating the British, of course, his foes at this point going back 35 years, he got in the last slash on the British with his victory at New Orleans. And of course, that was a date that was celebrated vigorously for a great many years, January 8th.
Right.
And of course, was the occasion of various statues of Jackson being put up in Washington, Jackson Square in New Orleans, very famous pictures there. And it was really a fundamental, a kind of shaping event of the early American Republic.
So one of the things I find so fascinating about this is it's sort of the building up of the popularity with his troops and getting them back to Tennessee, back to their homes and everything.
Sure.
And then he has got to more or less turn around and say, okay, guys, now we've got to go back down there and fight again. And they do. And then they win this big thing.
Yeah.
It must have been incredibly solidifying in terms of the popularity that would spread even within Tennessee, because the urban legends about the Great Battle and all that sort of stuff would be.
Sure, certainly. And of course, there are various close associates in those battles, various officers and so on that stick with him throughout his career.
Right, okay.
Though he does, I mean, Jackson is never far from controversy. At one point, there is some controversy with groups that say we only signed up for so many months, and Jackson's telling them they served up for the duration. They signed up for the duration, and he gets in trouble for the execution of several militiamen who are resisting.
Oh, okay.
So again, it's not as we might say in the 1800s a cakewalk, but he did have his detractors, and of course, in later campaigns, people would point out that sometimes he had his own men executed. He was a very tough commander, but there was the sense fortified by that very early episode in the War of 1812 that if you stuck with Jackson, he'd stick with you.
Okay, so now he's presumably back. This is 1815. He's back in Tennessee, and he doesn't run for president for almost another 10 years or so. But so is he gone back into law?
His main activity for a number of years was, I mean, he was, of course, greatly honored for a while.
Sure.
He had a rather controversial period where he retained martial law in New Orleans, and there were some cases over that.
Okay.
So he's never far from controversy in all kinds of small ways.
He sort of say he's a military governor of that area or something?
Well, of New Orleans for a little while, and then he is given a command over the southeast.
At
one point, there's a general over him, and then he replaces him, where he gets involved in continuing controversy in the Floridas.
Okay.
West Florida, sort of almost moreover toward Mobile and Biloxi, Mississippi, in my understanding of it. And, of course, East Florida, which is what we think of Florida pretty much today.
Right, okay.
The border's unsettled and so on. There are not only issues with Native Americans, and, of course, the Seminole Indians, Florida, will be resisting U.S. control well through Jackson's administration, the 1830s, well into the 1850s. But you have some escaped Indians who have left, probably some of the losers of the battles with Jackson who have gone down there. And it's also an opportunity for slaves who are escaping from American jurisdiction in the hopes of getting their freedom.
Oh, going to Spanish Florida.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, at this time, Spanish control isn't very great or very strong.
Right.
This was a continuing problem for Spain over a couple hundred years, but that's the subject of another program, I guess, maybe with a glass of sangria or something. But Jackson, of course, is concerned with this disorder on the border, if you'll pardon the rhyme. And
That's very hashtagable, though.
I'll take whatever I can get.
In these Twitter days.
well, we could Twitter on down to the border and enjoy that. But Jackson's concern is making things more orderly. And of course, he's realized for some time, as a great many Americans have, that the Floridas are ripe for the taking. Why shouldn't America have the whole continent?
Okay.
And while the phrase manifest destiny hasn't been invented, it hasn't been used yet,
right,
this sense of sort of filling out the continent, regardless of who might happen to be there, is very much of a phenomenon in the 1800s. And you can see Andrew Jackson as an exemplar of it. Anyway, in Florida, he believes he can take Florida for the United States and sort of sends various letters to then-President Monroe about it. President Monroe never says to him, go ahead and take it. But I think Monroe is, you know, neither does President Monroe and that time his Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun, who will come back in the story a number of times, and Secretary of State John Quincy Adams.
Right.
They don't tell, you know, they don't give him clear orders to stop. And so in the course of regular pursuit, he runs into two British subjects, men named Ambrister and Arbuthnot, that have various, at least according to Jackson, shady relations with the Native Americans. The idea the British are trying to stir them up again. Poor Arbuthnot is 70 years old, and I'm close enough to that age that I have suspicion Arbuthnot wasn't quite as dangerous a figure as Jackson might have thought.
Yeah.
But anyway, these two British subjects are executed under the orders of General Jackson.
Okay.
As his troops are sort of marching across northern Florida all the way towards St. Augustine.
So in a way, Jackson's sort of like the military commander for the Southeast in a way, or certainly—
Yes. Okay. I think that's a good way to characterize it. It's a little more complex with that, but I think that's fine for our listeners.
So he's famous for the Battle of New Orleans, and then he goes on. This must be continued to mention in the national press with this sort of stuff as well.
Sure.
Okay, so it's not like he's forgotten until the election of 1824.
No. And his execution of Ambrister and Arbuthnot does annoy the British. Mm-hmm. And there's talk of the possibility of war, of course, in those times where it took, you know, months for information to get back and forth. These issues sort of would hang out there for a while, and there no war occurred. Mm-hmm. And of course, it led to the negotiations that had been going on for a while with Spain to buy the Floridas from Spain. And those negotiations are under the jurisdiction of the control of Secretary of State John Quincy Adams.
Okay.
And so the United States gets the Floridas. I believe the treaty's completed in 1820 or 21. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that what Jackson's military efforts proved was that Spain couldn't hang on to this effectively. The United States was interested, and there was a lot of dispute over whether or not Jackson's actions were legal under international law. International law, of course, isn't very clear and isn't enforceable, just like today. And so he helped to take the Floridas from Spain, and the United States gets it with Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, soon to be a political foe of Jackson's. And so he's involved in that way. And then at that point, he returns to Tennessee, but he quickly becomes he is always a national figure.
Right.
He's more recognizable than most political figures, even national political figures, and you start to get talk of Jackson running for the presidency.
Okay. Well, so we're still talking about the late teens and early 20s then, right?
I'd say the early 1820s. There's a beginning of talk about it. This is a period known as the so-called era of good feelings.
Right.
There was no clear division of parties. The old division of the Federalists and the Jeffersonians or Democratic Republicans that had governed in the early decades of the nation has pretty much fallen apart. In the election of 1820, James Monroe, not that he was so well known or beloved a figure, but there was so little opposition to him that there was only one electoral vote cast against him by an elector who said he thought only George Washington should have received unanimous election. So he had nothing against President Monroe, but really he shouldn't be reelected unanimously. So that shows a very low level of conflict. But lots of people are getting ready for 1824, when Monroe will have completed his second term. George Washington has established the tradition,
right,
followed by Thomas Jefferson, and of course followed by Madison and Monroe, of just serving two terms. It was legal to try to serve another term,
sure,
but no one tried to do it until Franklin Roosevelt many years later. So 1824 sets up to be the opportunity for a number of major politicians. Of course, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State, a number of Secretaries of State had succeeded to the presidency.
Sure.
Henry Clay of Kentucky, a very important figure in Congress. John C. Calhoun, who had been Secretary of War, I mentioned. And there are others. And there's the beginnings of talk about Jackson.
Okay. Well, that's a good place for us to take a pause and have a word from our sponsors, Harry's Razors. And I'm sure we're still, of course, talking about a period where all the presidents and all the presidential candidates and all major politicians are still clean shaven. They're not, it's not part of this later 19th century, you know, Lincoln-esque bearded figures that we have all the way up to Garfield.
Maybe some slight side whiskers. I think John Quincy Adams had such little hair, if I recall correctly, that he might have had some side whiskers. But no, that's certainly the case.
Okay, back in a minute, Buzzkillers. That's right. Here we are down in the advertising department at the Buzzkill Institute. You know, Buzzkillers, we're so happy that like many, many famous and important people in history, we use Harry's Razors. I've been using them for close to 2 years, long before they sponsored us, because I got sick to death of those ripoff razor companies charging me $4 or more a blade at the drugstore. And I got tired of them jacking up their prices every year in order to justify their new and latest improved versions. Well, Harry's razors are better than that. Harry's razors have a fantastic soft flex hinge. They have a trimmer blade that Abraham Lincoln used and that I use all the time. Lubricating strip, great handle. It's great control while you shave. They're the best razors out there, and their prices are still just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more that you pay to rip off razor companies at the drugstore. How do they do that? The good Buzzkillers at Harry's bought their own factory in Germany. They make the best blades out there, and they sell them directly to you over the internet, cutting out the middleman, taking a slightly smaller profit in the beginning, and that's how they keep their prices the same. No matter how many times they improve their razors, the prices remain the same. And Harry's has a special offer for you Buzzkillers out there. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. Free trial set has a razor, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. You only pay a tiny amount for shipping, plus just for you Buzzkillers, just for my listeners, enter the code BUZZKILL, BUZZKILL at checkout, and you get the post-shave balm for free with your order. Post-shave balm, great. You'll look better, you'll feel better all day when you use it. Let me repeat that. Go to harrys.com, enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout. You get great razor, blades, shave cream, and the post-shave balm for free. Do it now, Buzzkillers. You'll thank me after you've done it. Now, back upstairs to the research part of the Institute. So we're back from the advertising department. And so, Professor, in the run-up to the 1824 election, the early 1824s, it's not as if Jackson comes out of the backwoods as a complete unknown and is seen as this, you know, Tennessee bumpkin. He's got national traction, so to speak, and he's a war hero and a frontier hero.
Well, what I would say is that the political leaders of the time, I think, mm-hmm. tended to view him as a Tennessee bumpkin.
Okay.
And that based on those who had come recently with, they may have been great political philosophers like James Madison.
Right.
They may have had, they all had long careers in government like John Quincy Adams and James Monroe, John Adams, diplomatic careers and so on. Compared to that kind of background, Jackson, his main success was as a military hero and a very controversial right. military hero at
right,
that.
Okay.
So I think the governing classes, to the extent we can use that phrase, and we should
right.
use it cautiously, didn't really think much of the possibility of a Jackson presidency. But where he resonated was with the people. The nation
okay.
is moving toward universal manhood white suffrage. There
right.
are a few states where African-Americans with property, and there weren't many of those, of course,
right.
most of them were slaves, could vote. But largely it's white males who are getting the vote. Even in 1824, I think less than half of the states awarded their electoral college votes. And of course, the electoral college has a long history.
Yeah.
About half awarded them on the basis of the popular vote. another half just, you know, were selected in various other ways. And so there's a rising sense of the power of the people in our government.
Okay.
And what Andrew Jackson had, his accomplishments may not have impressed especially, probably scared as much as impressed some of the governing classes, but to the people, they had heard of Jackson's success in the War of 1812.
Okay.
They had heard that he wasn't afraid to execute Britishers who were thought to be meddling, and
right.
that, you know, he played a role in clearing out escaped slaves and escaped Indians in Florida and making it a new territory of the United States.
Right.
Those kind of things, the word did get around, even though we're before even the telegraph at this time.
Yeah.
And there was also a sense of his strong personality, his mm-hmm. the affection of most of his men for him and his strength as a public figure. And that set him apart from those who had generally governed the nation at the national level. But at the same time, it made him much more appealing to the people.
Right.
That is, the males who are able to vote in increasing numbers through right. the 1820s.
Is there any parallel at the time that we know of anyway? But he's the sort of next general. He's a general like General Washington. It seems to me he's being portrayed in a way as a kind of a nation builder because he's adding to the mm-hmm, territory mm-hmm, of Florida mm-hmm, and all yeah. that sort of stuff. I'm just wondering if there's a sort of like this is a frontier Washington, if you will.
Well, there is there certainly is that sense because he was he was born not all that much farther west.
right.
But in fact, that was a frontier area at the time. He goes on to even more of a frontier area, Tennessee,
yeah.
which is not one of the original 13 states.
No.
And so he's seen as a Westerner. His upbringing is far more humble than any of the previous presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, John Adams had a rather humble upbringing, but that I think is largely forgotten. His son certainly profited from his father's great success as a colonial lawyer and a fighter for liberty and so on. So I think he puts together the frontier appeal. And of course, the nation is moving west very rapidly. This sense of a humble upbringing and a sense of a man who stood up for America, who wanted to make America great. Let's put mm-hmm. it that way, in very obvious ways that the people could see. I mean, John Quincy Adams had accomplishments as Secretary of State in making America great. John C. Calhoun had planned various fortifications and so on and had worked in his career to make America great. But it wasn't obvious in the way and the sense of direct physical courage that Jackson showed first as a willing duelist, but later on as a fighter against Native Americans and the bloody British, and of course later a few Spaniards and Native Americans and escaped slaves down in Florida.
So is it the case then that he's able to build on this to sort of run for president in 1824, or is he sort of recruited to run for president in 1824?
At that time, presidential candidates had always sort of come out of a congressional caucus. Congress would decide who can get some support in that, and that would push people forward. Jackson was clearly an anti-caucus candidate. He had great popularity in Tennessee. The Tennessee legislature, as some other legislators had with sort of favorite son candidates from a particular state, they wanted to break up this sense of the congressional caucus, essentially nominating candidates. And so he was such a popular figure, he was put forward.
I don't want to say drain the swamp, but yes.
Well, that becomes one of his main initiatives when he gets closer to the presidency.
Right. Okay.
But he is put forward by the Tennessee legislature in 1822 as a possible presidential candidate. The legislature essentially endorses him, saying that we don't want to wait to hear what Congress says. We are putting forward General Jackson. And I think, my sense of the reaction is at first, they can put forward whomever they want. And of course, Jackson mm-hmm. is relatively, he's 55 years old in 1822. Now that may not seem very old to us. Of course, we're coming up on the oldest president to take power in the inauguration. But at that time, I think that was seen as rather old for a presidential candidate, you know, sort of to be beginning the presidency. We had men mainly in their 50s, I think, at that time. I think entirely in their 50s. And so what I think surprised a great many people was the popular reaction. Now, sure, there were people writing newspapers, and there's an age of growing number of newspapers, even, as I said before the Telegraph. But Jackson had, as we might say in this era, his candidacy had legs. And people were, I think again, the people in authority, or at least looking for more authority, were somewhat surprised at that. But it was very clear. One example of the power of Jackson's popularity was that it very quickly drove John C. Calhoun out of the race, Calhoun of South Carolina. He had hoped to be a good candidate for 1824, but he very quickly, after Jackson is put forward by the Tennessee legislature, is becoming more and more popular, and not just in the South, in Pennsylvania as well. He's especially popular in Pennsylvania. Okay. What Calhoun decides to do is essentially drop out of the race and say he'll run for vice president, with the hope of making an alliance with Jackson, because he understands Jackson's popularity. John Quincy Adams, of course, the Secretary of State, he stays in the race and he has strong support in the North. There's William Crawford of Georgia, who has some support, but he also has a stroke at this time. But that doesn't really take him out. You know, again, they can't take pictures of Crawford in his hospital bed. You know, there's always the hope that he'll recover. I'm sure his aides are especially hopeful he'll recover. And Henry Clay of Kentucky is a candidate. But I think of all those, all of the candidates except Jackson were, and of course Calhoun as well, were anticipated as being good candidates in 1824. Jackson was somewhat of a surprise.
Okay.
But his popularity pushes him very quickly to the front of the pack.
But the front of the pack of what? Is it help the buzzkillers here and help me a little bit. Are we talking about party nominations at this stage?
No. Because recall what I said about 1820 being the election where only one elector
voted against
Monroe.
So it's still a congressional thing.
The old parties of Federalists and Democratic Republicans or Jeffersonians had broken down.
Okay.
And so it really becomes a matter of people cohering around various individuals at the national level. And, of course, as those individuals start to make it clear, campaigns weren't really all that vigorous in those days. Certainly, there's very little personal campaigning, but people campaigned for you.
Yeah.
And there were issues that people had to take – well, at least were asked to take stands on. The tariff, what was charged on goods coming into the country, was an important issue. Jackson gives a kind of vague, moderate statement on it about the tariff, neither supporting it fully nor calling for its reduction. And so word gets around of different issues that some of these candidates might be more supportive on than less. A sense of their record is there. But really, the thing that defines most of the candidates is the section of the country that they come from.
Oh, okay.
You know, New Englanders will vote for a fellow New Englander like Jackson.
Adams,
yes. Yeah. Calhoun hoped to have great Southern appeal. He sees that overwhelmed by Jackson.
Right.
Crawford still had some Southern appeal. Clay, I'm sure, saw himself as the candidate of the West. But the one person who had more appeal in more places was Jackson.
Okay, because so Jackson has the South and the West.
Well, he has a good portion of the South, a good portion of the West, but he's also very, very popular in Pennsylvania. Hmm. And so we start to see, in Jackson, we start to see a candidate whose appeal is not just limited to the part of the country he's from, where he knows people and people campaign for him and so on. It's starting to extend beyond that.
Okay.
And we see it in Jackson, though that remains an important factor in American politics. We can certainly go through 1860 in the election I talked about a number of weeks ago for our buzzkillers.
But he loses in 1824 to John Quincy Adams.
Yes, he receives the largest number of popular votes.
Oh.
But he does not receive a majority of the popular vote. And of course, the popular vote is seen as even far less relevant than it is today.
Yeah.
So he receives...
You mean he receives a majority of... He doesn't receive a majority of the electoral college votes.
He doesn't receive a majority of any of the votes. Oh, he receives the largest number of electoral votes and the largest number of popular votes.
Oh, but it's not a majority. Okay,
but gotcha, he does not receive... I mean, of course... Whatever number of popular votes he received would not elect him or not, just as it did in the most recent election.
Right.
But a good number of states don't even have a popular vote to determine what the electoral vote is. Jackson is the leading candidate in both tallies.
Goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Well, but of course, there isn't a sense. I mean, again, with a number of states not even having a popular vote, it's a kind of arguing point that Jackson supporters make a good use of, but it isn't seen as determinative. And while he has the largest number of electoral votes, it's a minority. And of course, at that point, the election goes into the House of Representatives.
Okay.
And there's always talk about elections going into the House of Representatives, but it's only happened twice, once in 1800 and again in 1824.
Oh, it doesn't happen in 1876?
It does not go to the process outlined in the Constitution. Each state delegation voting for one for a candidate. The House does play a role in trying to accept a certain set of disputed ballots from the American South, but that is not the election going into the House through as the Constitution outlines, where each state ends up having a vote based on what its congressional delegation decides to do.
That's
what happens in 1800 and then in 1824.
Oh, okay.
And Jackson is not successful in 1824. John Quincy Adams is, in part because of the support. What happens in when an election goes to the House, according to the Constitution being amended after 1800, and the other election that goes in the House, is that the top three candidates are considered by the House of Representatives. Henry Clay has received the lowest number of electoral votes, so he is dropped out. Mm-hmm. But Henry Clay shares a number of ideas with John Quincy Adams, especially as far as a more active national government. And Adams, at some point or another, makes it clear that he at least would be willing to consider Clay as Secretary of State. A number of Secretary of States have gone on to the presidency. This, of course, is what Adams, the Secretary of State, is looking to do in 1824. And so the election goes into the House. And with support from Clay, Adams is able to get enough of the states behind him from their congressional delegations that he defeats Jackson.
Okay.
Soon thereafter, he announces that, lo and behold, Henry Clay will become Secretary of State. And of course, the Jackson supporters and Jackson himself cry foul very vigorously. It's known as the corrupt bargain.
Oh, right.
What is really corrupt, I think if we look at American politics after that time, this may not seem all that corrupt, but I think it's seen as especially corrupt in the mind of the Jacksonians, in that not only has Adams managed to defeat Jackson through getting Clay's support, but he is lining up Clay to be his successor.
Neither
of them were the choice of the people. But
again,
the idea is that they are subverting the will of the people. And of course, at one time, the will of the people was not seen as quite so important a thing in American politics,
but
it is arising at this time. And so that claim makes Jackson a more important figure, a more powerful figure, and for many, a more beloved figure leading up to 1828, when he does win the presidency, defeating the incumbent, turning John Quincy Adams out of office, and of course Henry Clay along with him.
And do we think that that's why? I mean, is there enough hangover from 1824, both in terms of the way the presidency was chosen, but also this rising popular attraction of Jackson is the reason he wins in 1828?
Well, of course, a lot of our evidence are the newspapers of the time. Newspapers tended to be very partisan, so there are people saying great things about Jackson, people saying nasty things about him. But what is clear in 1828 is that, I mean, first, there really aren't other candidates in the field other than the incumbent Adams and Jackson. Jackson wins a clear majority in the Electoral College. And by that time, I think practically every state, I think there are still only two states. We have about, by that time, maybe 24, 25 in the Union by 1828. but only two states don't have a popular vote determining the slates of electors in the Electoral College, and Jackson wins a substantial victory.
Okay,
so in the popular vote, so that's so, that's what that thinking's based on.
So it's amazing also how the how these electoral rules and electoral practices are evolving and changing, and how they're becoming more popular in the 1820s. At the same time, Jackson is building up this popular image.
Certainly, yes. And I think in just thinking about Jackson for a long time, I mean, Jackson's current status in the popular mind is relatively low. Mm-hmm. But in for many years throughout American history, this era, before this pre-Civil War era, was seen as the Jacksonian era.
Right.
And historians have argued, well, how much is that what Jackson does? And of course, he does have his accomplishments. But also, isn't it also a matter of what's going on at the time? That mm-hmm. America is moving west. So that's what makes his frontier experience appealing. That more Americans are voting. Of course, almost entirely white and male. But right. more of them are voting, more participating, more in government. And so there is this certainly growth of democracy, but some historians have emphasized, let's not put it all on Jackson. It wasn't like Jackson told America to be democratic.
Let's do all that. Yeah,
yes, right. And in many ways it happened at the same time, and Jackson was the beneficiary of it. Mm-hmm. And of course, if things had turned out differently in 1824, and let's say Jackson had managed to make a deal and to be successful, you might have seen different arguments coming out about that, but it really worked out perfectly for Jackson to claim this corrupt bargain, this anti-democratic bargain between the man who won Adams and the man who certainly wanted to succeed him and would run against Jackson later on, Henry Clay of Kentucky.
Okay. So then Jackson wins in 1828, he's inaugurated in 1829. What does he do in his first term? What are the big sort of things that make it Jacksonian?
Well, often with Jackson's leadership, it is less, I think our buzzkillers need to get away from the model of a president saying, on day one, I will do this, and the other thing.
Executive order number one, things like
that. Yes, of course, many things worked more slowly first.
Sure.
But beyond that, the president was not seen as so much a proposer of action. He was a reactor, but Jackson did react very strongly and in a way much more strongly than had ever been seen in the presidency. He compiled for that time a record number of vetoes of congressional mm-hmm. legislation. He was at one point referred to by his opponents as King Veto, there were lots of criticism of Jackson as being dictatorial.
Right,
Is he a man of the people or not? Well, maybe not. He was referred to as King Andrew for dictatorial kinds of action or kingly kind of actions.
You see a lot of political cartoons along those
lines. Sure. He was bitterly criticized for all that. Of course, the party that came to that coalesced to oppose him took on the name Whig.
Yeah.
Okay, from the British opponents of the king, mm-hmm. those favoring the king being the Tories. So we can sort of see that kind of a sense in Jackson. But there was controversy in Jackson's term from the very beginning. We're coming up on an inauguration, and Jackson's inauguration excited controversy because Adams and Jackson disliked each other intensely. Adams's forces had actually brought up the charges of adultery that had led to several duels back in the 1790s and 1800s Jackson. Yeah. And it was a terribly bitter campaign. It's really sort of the first campaign we see with that kind of bitterness and personal attacks. I mean, we see American politics getting more personal and more bitter throughout this whole period coming up to today. But because of that, the Jackson and Adams transition forces didn't communicate. And so there were no security arrangements in place for Jackson's inaugural reception. And that led to all kinds of folks who were excited to come into Washington and see Jackson be inaugurated. Yeah. But the reception was open, and they sort of stormed the White House, and they broke punch bowls, and they destroyed furniture. And at one point, Jackson, sort of his aides, had to gather around him and sort of hustle him out for fear that he might be overrun by the people who loved Jackson, but weren't very careful when they got a chance to get into the White House. So even at that time, there was a sense that the people are dealt, you know, many of the old hands around Washington said, oh my God, this is democracy at its worst, or mob rule. So there's controversy from that point. As far as steps Jackson took, he certainly was strongly supportive of the expulsion of Native Americans to the west of the Mississippi. He always couched this in a kind of paternalist sort of fashion, that it would be better for them, that they could not, they could not successfully amalgamate with whites east of the Mississippi, so let's send them to the west. And that eventuated just after his administration in the Trail of Tears of the Cherokee and other tribes. And that was very controversial at the time. He ran into trouble very quickly in his first term over the tariff, because South Carolina, led by his vice president, Calhoun had been Adams's vice president. He was elected vice president in 1824. He stayed on as Jackson's vice president in 1828, which shows sort of the difference and sort of lack of strong political ties in this period. But Calhoun had been more concerned about the impact of the tariff on the South, the idea that a tariff that made European manufactured goods, especially British manufactured goods, more expensive to help Northeastern manufacturers would increase costs for Southern plantation owners and Southern farmers.
Okay.
And that controversy got to be so intense that Calhoun, while he was still Jackson's vice president, was advising and writing documents calling for the nullification of the tariff. Now, this was not quite secession, which, of course, comes out of South Carolina another 30 years. But the idea is that if a state, really the sense was that the American Union was in some ways voluntary, and if a state really objected to a law of Congress, it would then have the right to nullify that law through a decision of the state legislature and just not follow it. And the only recourse for the rest of the country would be to pass a constitutional amendment, essentially confirming that whatever it was that state didn't like was constitutional, and eventually ratified by 3/4 of the states. And if that was done, then the state that had nullified would go back to obeying the law. But not until a constitutional amendment had confirmed the law would that be done.
And those are very difficult,
So there have been a good number of constitutional amendments, but they weren't on sort of basic laws like the tariff and so on, by and large. Yeah. So, but Jackson very quickly got the sense that Calhoun was not as strong a proponent of the federal union as he was, and in a and these are the kind of ways political communication would occur in those days, as opposed to Twitter and so on today, at a dinner.
By the way, what year are we talking about here? Well, so that we know where we are. Ish.
This is the 1828 tariff is very controversial. So it really is a controversy from the very beginning of Jackson's administration. Okay. You can even find roots before. But I believe the dinner I'm going to mention, where there's sort of a personal confrontation in the trading of toasts, was in 1830. And it's in 1832 that the South Carolina legislature nullifies the tariff. Refuses for a few months to collect it, and Jackson essentially forces them to do so, followed by a compromise on the tariff, gradually lowering it. So South Carolina at the end of 1832 and into early 1833 is threatening to leave the Union over this issue. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yes, but in 1830 at a big dinner, Jackson asked for a toast, and the story is that he looks right at Calhoun. And his toast is, and I think I have this right, our federal union, it must be preserved. And he sort of stares at Calhoun. And there is some question whether Calhoun's hand shakes or not, depending on what account you read. But he responds, our federal union next to our liberties most dear. He's sort of hedging it a little bit, though he is responding. At that time, Calhoun's still president. Calhoun becomes, at the end of 1832.
Still vice president, you mean.
Yes, thank you. That at the end of 1832, he will, just before the end of his term, he will resign the vice presidency. He's the first vice president to resign, preceding Spiro Agnew many years later.
But
this controversy over the tariff becomes a controversy about the federal union and its solidity. And Jackson very vigorously, even though he's a Southerner, he's a slaveholder, a lot of people in the South are saying, well, if they can pass a tariff we don't like, and of course, it's the beginnings of abolition. You start to have William Lloyd Garrison and David Walker's appeal, a very famous document. You get the very beginnings of abolition, the end of the 1820s, the early 1830s. But a lot of Southerners are thinking a strong federal government may well force us to curtail slavery. And of course, it will end up being a controversy further west and as new states come into the Union. But that thinking is around the time, and that's certainly involved with this sense of the tariff. It's not merely about the cost of the tariff.
Because I think one of the things certainly in college and in reading American history, think of the tariff as really a financial, it has this states' rights element to it, but obviously a financial problem and an economic problem. But of course, then if the principle of the tariff is states' rights and nullification or the anti-tariff crowd, then that obviously leads on.
Well, I think it was one of the relatively few pieces of national legislation that could have impact even down to your good old general store.
So
in that way, if you're debating national politics, the tariff becomes a crucial issue. There's a lot of talk of protection. Maybe the tariff will become a big issue again in various ways.
That's one of the things that was in the campaign.
Coming up. But there was this growing sense in the South of sort of fear that the federal government might be less and less under their control. And if it were, it could move against slavery. And so there was a sense of making a stand to limit federal power. South Carolina did not get much support from other southern states over nullification, and Jackson successfully accomplished. He even at one point had plans to bring federal troops into South Carolina. That wasn't done, but he was planning on it to sort of unite with the Unionists in South Carolina and plans to collect tariffs off the shore of South Carolina. And I really don't know if any of those tariffs were actually collected. It was really settled pretty quickly early in 1833 after Congress, under Henry Clay's leadership, who's still trying to play a role in all this.
Supposedly the Great Compromise.
This is one of his first compromises, to gradually lower the tariff. And Jackson didn't oppose. Jackson didn't especially love the tariff, but he wanted to. So Jackson emphasizes the principle that the federal union will not be, will be preserved, will not be dissolved, even through nullification. And Clay gives South Carolina and the rest of the South who's concerned about this issue to, gives them the lowering the tariff.
A kind of an out.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, also in Jackson's first term, he makes it clear, it's really, some historians call the rise of the spoils system, which was predominant in American politics for many years, whereas once a new president came in, all offices under his power were replaced with people who supported him. Now, this could also be called draining the swamp. Lots of talk about that. The reference to the story of Hercules was often used. I think one of Hercules's tasks was cleaning the Augean stables. I don't really know what the Augean stables were like, but there must have been a great deal in the stalls of the Augean stables. And that was sort of the original sense of this draining the swamp.
But Hercules had to divert a river to do that. So
however it could be done, but the idea was to clean things up in Washington if you are in favor of the new administration, or saying that they're getting rid of anyone who's competent and new folks are coming in without the kind of skills necessary. But we first see that kind of issue with Jackson's entrance into this. And Jackson did make a statement, again, showing his support of democracy with a small d, saying that really all government posts should be something that just a kind of basically educated person should handle. They shouldn't require special expertise. They shouldn't be the province of the elite. And of course, people criticize him for that. This is long before we get any kind of professional civil service. The controversies over this continue for many years. But we do see that in Jackson's first administration.
Okay, let's move on then to the sort of big issues that at least ignite passions these days about Jackson's historical legacy, his memory, the Indian removal, and things like that. Because I think it's so fascinating what you say about this whole, this mindset Jackson has about the paternalism and the sort of the leading the country as a father, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Surely.
So how do these things come about?
Well, that's his view of Native Americans, that he is, and you know, a lot of this I think is nothing other than self-deception, but the idea that he cares for all the people, whether they are citizens with the right to vote. Certainly he would see himself as someone who greatly cared about women from the you know, his love for his beloved Rachel, who actually—
and standing up for her all the time.
Yes. And she actually dies just before he takes office. And he always blames it on all of the attacks on her in the 1828 campaign. So that remains a very bitter issue. But he would say he cares for women. He cares for the slaves. On his deathbed, he says, "We will all meet in heaven, all black and white." And there are stories of slaves weeping by his bedside along with family members. And so I'm sure he sees himself as a good master, though it certainly didn't stop him. We have letters of him saying, you know, "When you catch that fellow, put on 30 lashes, well laid to him," you know. So, but he would claim that kind of paternal sort of concern.
And it kind of harkens back to his taking care of the Tennessee troops in the Battle of New Orleans and all that sort of,
same kind of thing.
And he can also then presumably see the benefit that comes from that when he adopts a paternal attitude. He gets great loyalty.
Well, and even in his personal life, I mean, he does, he finds an orphaned baby. I'm trying to think if it's a Creek or a Chickasaw.
Native
named
American.
Lincoya, a boy that he raises until his death at the age of 16, but he becomes part of Jackson's household. So even in that sense, he claims this kind of paternal sense and sensibility.
Yeah.
But of course, the sense of any paternalist is that, you know, you sort of look at your children. Well, of course, our children, we all hope, depending on their abilities or disabilities, that they can go on to full adulthood. The problem with the paternalist is often that there are groups that the paternalist doesn't see as ever qualifying for that. And I don't think you know, Jackson didn't have a particularly, he certainly respected a great many women and respected their opinions, but he didn't, he wasn't a crusader for women's rights. He certainly didn't see Native Americans as capable of full citizenship or any aspect of citizenship. Except perhaps a few that I'm sure, you know, like his foster child, of course, doesn't grow up. We don't get to see, but he does raise him in his household. And of course, with African Americans, he does at certain points in his military career have free black troops. I think there are some free black troops in New Orleans that he encourages to fight against the British. But I have no doubt that he shared, and we have no evidence that he didn't share the racist attitudes of his day. So the great problem for the paternalist is that some of his children aren't likely to grow up.
And so
when there are whole classes of people that, you know, to our general view, don't seem to be all that different, how do you justify it? But I think that's at least the way that historians have seen Jackson justifying his approach to the groups for which now today he's, you know, clearly he wasn't an advocate of women's rights. Clearly he was a slaveholder. And clearly, of course, he presided over the expulsion of Native Americans from the eastern part of the nation.
But does he think of this as a, you know, let's say the Indian removal as a way that eventually things will work out because I'm doing this better for the entire whole, and that maybe not this generation of Native Americans who are moved west, but maybe their children will come to benefit from my paternal control in setting out a new country.
I think his sense, and it goes with the thinking of the time, and of course of many of the people who criticized him, who I think wanted him to be more gentle, but didn't see a kind of equal place. Most of them didn't see a place of equality for Native Americans. I think Jackson would say they must go to a place where they can carry on their, I think he'd use this phrase, savage lives, as they have done. That since they're not able to assimilate into modern American life at that time, they must go a place where they can hunt and fish and carry on as they always have. I think...
Again, this is very much Jackson's attitude, not what historians have
done. Certainly. But I think also at that time, there wasn't the... I don't think most Americans had clearly come to grips with how rapid their growth was. I remember a phrase from...
You mean the rapid growth of the country?
Yes. Okay. There's a phrase from Thomas Jefferson about the Louisiana Purchase that I recall, and I think there would be enough land for the 1,000th generation.
Right.
Well, 1,000th generation is a long time, and while I'm sure we could find some land somewhere in the Louisiana Purchase, it's probably not the best. The best land was certainly probably easily taken up within certainly 100, if not fewer years. And so I think, again, the sense of over to the Mississippi, well, it'll be a long time before we cross the Mississippi. We might do it sometime, and we'll see, or maybe, I mean, the plains were for a long time referred to as the Great American Desert.
Well, that's right, yeah.
And it was sort of a sense, oh, sure, send them out there. There won't be any problem. And, of course, it was a kind of, you know, again, a wish fulfillment to make people feel as if they were doing something humane or decent, and decent in the long run. But their sense of the long run was ultimately variable, I'll put it that way.
Oh, right. Well, that's fascinating because, of course, we're dealing with two things, geographical spread and sort of ethnic national spread.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
I was thinking of... Sure. Of different groups, but also how the country is going to develop as a white-dominated
westward. And I think he was fully in favor of that sense of domination of the continent. He was he was in favor of the annexation of Texas, which comes up toward the end of his term, though it isn't accomplished till 1845.
Okay.
But again, I think where it's convenient on an issue like the Native Americans, he was going to maintain this kind of paternalist facade, tell himself in his own mind that, well, that puts this problem off for a long time. And who knows what will happen in the long run of providence and so on. Maybe he'd phrase it something like that. He was always talking about providence. But it sort of put it aside, and then he could deal with sort of more basic issues and greater controversies that, colored his term.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because in a way he's kind of a bridging figure between the 18th century and the 19th century, because after his second term is over, he lives for quite a while.
Well, he's around for 8 years. I do feel compelled to talk just a bit about his second term, his winning a second term. And of course, nullification was part of an issue for that. But also a major issue was the Bank of the United States, private bank with a long history by that point. We don't have to go into the currency issues. Of course, Jackson's involvement in currency issues continues to this day. But the Bank of the United States was seen as a terribly powerful organization in which the government's funds were deposited.
Presumably in New York.
Well, their headquarters were Philadelphia. They had branched all over the country.
Okay,
yes,
okay.
Yes, it was Philadelphia. Again, you know, the first bank goes back to the 1790s, you know, very early in the nation. But we didn't have a national currency. The Bank of the United States was a private institution. It could issue its own currency. Any bank could issue currency based its resources
and its
charters and so on. That's not our purpose here. But Jackson saw this powerful economic institution as essentially something that corrupted a number of politicians, and many important politicians, including Daniel Webster, received retainers from the Bank of the United States. And he saw it as having too much power in the economy, even though, again, it's not anything like the Federal Reserve today. It was largely a private institution. The government held stock and puts deposits in there, as I mentioned. But Jackson saw it as too powerful for the proper development of a democratic nation with a small d, even though Jackson is in the process founding the big D Democratic Party. And so he conducts his own war against the bank. And that's the big issue in 1832, where he is against one of his old foes and one of the bank's foremost proponents, Henry Clay of Kentucky. And Clay
always seems to crop up again and again.
Yes, yes. And Clay gets the idea that if he just gets the recharter of the bank, it has to be rechartered every 20 years, Clay pushes for it early. in 1832. It's not up till 1836, sort of to force Jackson, who has been a little unclear about what he thinks about the bank in public in 1832. And the idea is that if Jackson will either have to recharter the bank or he will face the wrath of the voters and Henry Clay in 1832. Well, Jackson responds with the very famous phrase, I think in a discussion with Martin Van Buren, who will succeed him and become his vice president after Calhoun. He says, you know, the bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it. And so he vetoes the recharter of the bank and goes on through the rest of his term through various economic measures to destroy it. The voters endorse, as they tended to do, they endorse the actions of President Jackson by a larger victory than he had in 1828. In 1832, he defeats Clay, and the bank federal deposits are taken out. Very complex kind of, you know, set of events. But he does kill the Bank of the United States. Many economists have criticized that this wasn't the best move for a developing nation that needed a more reliable currency. Uh-huh. But as far as Jackson was concerned, this was the bank was a gift to the powerful and the potent, as he used in his his veto of the bank, and that he would take action, that we can't have this kind of engine of corruption, as he saw it, in the economy. So that's really the major issue.
Because there's like the second power. There's the government, and then there's this thing called the Bank of the United States, which is almost in many ways rival to at least Jackson's idea.
Oh, as far as economic power, it clearly had massive economic power, and it wasn't clearly under the control of the president. Congress criticized him for taking deposits out of the bank, many of them saying, like Clay, that wasn't in the power of the president. It was only in the power of Congress. Censure vote in the Senate. The Senate censured him. And Jackson was so annoyed at that. One of the last acts in his presidency was to get the Senate to expunge the censuring resolution, take it out of the Senate journal. And of course, there were senators at the time who said, it happened. We can't remove it as much as you don't like it. But Jackson had enough support to have it removed. Wow. And, of course, he's also, I think, this deserves mention, as the first president where there were efforts to assassinate him. You know, I'm not aware of others before that.
The first six.
1833, there's a man who attacks him while he's on, I think he's riding on a steamboat on the Potomac, going toward a kind of summer retreat that he had in Virginia. And that man does not have, he does not fire a gun at him. I'm not sure if he has a knife, Jackson, but he just sort of, you know, starts beating on the president and people take him away.
Wow.
And then there's a man in 1835, sort of works around the Capitol. I think he had been a painter or whatever, and he has a nice loaded weapon that he fires twice and it misfires. On the, I believe it's on the Capitol grounds. I think it's indoors. It was supposed to like a very moist day, and perhaps that's why it didn't fire. People saw it as, again, an act of providence in 1835 that this perfectly loaded gun, man firing at point blank range, didn't, I believe his name, his last name is Lawrence. Uh-huh. And he had had some mental issues and, you know, heard voices and so on. And Jackson sort of is a man sort of fires at him. Jackson gets his cane out. The president at that time is, I believe, 68 and sort of smacks on him with his cane, which is a very Jacksonian thing to do.
And presumably that also is enhanced in the press as the great, powerful, the American Lion, as he's later called.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, that sort of, I mean, he's going to respond. He's not going to cower.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Of course, you know, I'm sure there are people running to his aid, but that was very much the kind of man he was.
So he lives, as you say, for another 8 years after his presidency, and he lives long enough, among other things, in the early 1840s to have his photograph taken, which is astounding because he's 13 years old and he's slashed by a British officer in the Revolutionary War, and yet he lives almost to the time of the telegraph.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes, he telegraph and the photograph are just coming in, the daguerreotype, and he was I think, you know, after his presidency, he was still a beloved figure whenever he would appear in public. And of course, his health was declining, but when he would, people worshiped him in many ways. And I think this sense as, sure, he was a man of the people, but he was in no way an average man. And he I think the phrase is often the tribune of the people. He could represent the people. He could represent them at the highest level in the most vigorous kind of way, whether it was fighting the bloody British or killing the Bank of the United States, right, or, you know, his kind of general talent for plain speaking that mm-hmm. Americans have long appreciated in their mm-hmm. political figures. And of course, along with that, he had bitter foes. Right. As well, his success in establishing the Democratic Party, that was basically Jackson's party, and people were mm-hmm. Jacksonians. And the Whig Party, which precedes the Republican Party, it has a hard time holding itself together and, of course, falls apart in the 1850s. But it holds itself together pretty well in the 1830s as being anti-Jacksonian. All kinds of people who found Jackson dictatorial, or they might have had some sympathy with the Native Americans or with abolition. I mean, the issues of slavery come up toward the very end. I mean, he really is a bridge between the very early Republic and the Civil War, right, because toward the end of his term, abolitionist presses, and they're steam-powered presses by now.
Yeah. Newspaper presses.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, but also pamphlets and broadsides and printing, so on. Yeah. They send out all kinds of leaflets across the country, anti-slavery leaflets. Charleston, South Carolina, again, South Carolina, having kind of pioneering role in all these cases. South Carolina says, we can't let these get out there. You know, maybe people throw them in the trash, but who knows what slave will pick this pamphlet up and know that there are white people ready to declare that they should be free.
Wow.
So Jackson allows South Carolina basically to confiscate this part of the federal mail. I mean, in he's not supporting federal authority. He's not supporting federal authority and saying, well, it's in the federal mails, I don't care, because it's about slavery. And as far as Jackson is concerned, abolitionists are courting racial war.
Oh, okay.
Through that kind of publicizing. At the same time in Congress, there is an effort to send in petitions against slavery from various interest groups, abolitionists, and so on. And Congress adopts what's called the gag rule, saying we're not going to consider them. Again, a kind of basic right to petition your government. But the sense is that some slave somewhere might looking at the debates of Congress, probably reproduced in the newspapers. That was there was a threat of a rebellion in 1822 in South Carolina, where it was said that a free black had seen debates over the Missouri Compromise. So Jackson gets, again, not surprisingly, low marks, and he wasn't a civil libertarian.
No, yeah.
But we get that issue growing. And, of course, the issue of national expansion with what's going to happen with Texas. So he really does bridge that era in all kinds of ways, from being probably the first ex-president to be photographed. There are photographs of Martin Van Buren, who succeeds him. I don't know what date they were taken, but we do remember those photos. And if you haven't seen them, you can find many of them online.
And we're going to put them on our website.
Yeah, of this elderly man by that time. But he really does bridge those eras, from being slashed by a British officer to being perhaps the first ex-president ever to be photographed.
Well, this is a fascinating story. The whole invention of personality politics seems to be come up again and again and again.
I mean, with one thing after another, Jackson took it personally, and the word would get out, and not through Twitter, but in formats of that time, that Jackson had a real reaction to things. And it was, I think, the kind of thing that his friends, as well as his enemies, reacted to. And he wasn't a distant figure. He wasn't a kind of marble figure. He was a figure that people could identify with, from his humble upbringing to his
all the way to clear having spectacles in the photograph.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Throughout his career.
Right. Well, thank you very, very much, Professor. There you have it, Buzzkillers. You see, a lot of these things go way, way back to the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. And we'll talk to you next week.